I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Concussion, the new film starring Will Smith, opens on Christmas Day. It's about Dr. Bennett Omalu, a Pittsburgh-based pathologist who identified brain injury known as chronic traumatic encephalopathy in Pittsburgh Steeler Mike Webster. Here's a scene from the film where Omalu struggles to get the attention of the NFL to the dangers of the sport.
If you continue to deny my work, the world will deny my work. But men, your men, continue to die, their families left in ruins. Tell the truth. Tell the truth.
We asked Sean Gregory to join us. He's seen the film, covers sports for Time magazine, where he's a senior writer, and he interviewed Dr. Omalu. Later in the show, we'll be talking about what we know about CTE, contact sports, and the brain. Sean Gregory, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I do want to talk about the interview that you did with Dr. Omalu. You described it as a fiery conversation. Mm-hmm. Is he an angry man?
No, I think the context of that conversation was we did it late last week, and an article had come out where several doctors were questioning his claim that he discovered CTE. So there's this intramural medical fight going on. And so unprompted, he was kind of defensive about his accomplishments and kind of generally agitated about that. And so I think it just led to a very interesting look into his kind of personality. He's been doubted a lot, and, you know, he kind of wears his emotions on his sleeve. And you kind of, if you read that interview, that kind of comes out in full force a little bit. The most interesting, I think, newsy thing that he said in that interview was he believes that 90%, over 90% of NFL players have some form of CTE, the degenerative brain disease, that's been linked with football head trauma. I mean, that's a pretty bold claim, and, you know, whether the science ultimately bears that out, we'll see. His contention at the same time is not everybody that has CTE will have the terrible symptoms that we've seen in players like Mike Webster and others. Maybe you'll have some of the neuropathological signs of CTE, but, you know, be able to function. So anyway, there's a lot. There's just a lot going on right now in with this whole issue with the movie, with Dr. Omalu, with, you know, there were some reports yesterday that came out that the NFL's pulling funding for certain research into head trauma. The NIH disputed the ESPN had a report about it. The NIH and the NFL disputed that. So there's just lots swirling around.
Sure.
And in the middle of this comes this, you know, comes a movie out on Christmas Day, which dramatizes this whole thing and does not paint the NFL in a very nice light.
Sean, you mentioned Mike Webster, and that's the player that really, I guess, got people thinking about CTE. Mm-hmm. And you quote Dr. Omalu saying, "I mean, when I say I wish I never met Mike Webster, I mean every word of it. I wish I never met Mike mm-hmm. Webster. I would have been left alone." I mean, he regrets the controversy, or what is his regret about?
His regret is about the fight that he had to go through, and in his eyes, the attacks against him that came about from the NFL and from fellow scientists once he published this research saying that Mike Webster had this disease, and this disease, there's a good chance this disease was caused by the head trauma involved in football. When that was published in 2005, that was very controversial in the medical community, and the NFL fought hard against it. I mean, they tried to get that journal article retracted, and that tension is a big part of the movie. And, you know, I'm sure whether everything that was said in the movie was said in real life, obviously some of that's going to be dramatized, but the central tension is historically accurate, that the NFL fought hard against what Dr. Omalu was saying, and at the end of the day, Dr. Omalu has been vindicated in the sense that a lot, you know, since that article came out over the last decade, you know, other scientists have done research that has shown that a fair amount of of NFL players that have been studied, their brains have been studied after their deaths, showed signs of CTE, of the same kind of neurological, neuropathological buildup that we saw in Mike Webster's brain. And so Boston University, for example, which has been pioneering on this too, they've examined around 90 or so brains of retired NFL players, of deceased NFL players, and something like 96% of the brains that have studied, that they've studied, have shown signs of CTE. And it's important to also note that that doesn't mean that 90% of all NFL players have the disease.
Exactly.
There's a self-selection. I mean, the folks that are donating their brains to date, their families, they've had symptoms, right? So their families say, we want to know what was going on. Why was he depressed at the end of his life? Why did things go badly? And so, you know, the brains that are being sent to Boston University, there's a self-selection bias. So I think some people have extrapolated that figure to say, to just assume that all over 90% of NFL players are going to have serious brain damage. I think that's a stretch, although Dr. Malu said yesterday that to us that he thinks that over 90% of NFL players have this disease, with the caveat that some of them will have, you know, very mild symptoms. So there's a lot to be learned on this.
Indeed, there is. You asked him, would you let your son play football? He says, my son is six. I wouldn't let my six-year-old son near any football field. And if any coach asks my son to play football, I'll sue that coach and I'll sue the school. I mean, he is on a mission here, it seems. Does he want to stop football in America?
Well, it's interesting. He says stuff like that, but at the same time, he goes out of his way to say, no, I'm not. I don't want to ban football. I mean, I think what he's saying is, for kids, you shouldn't be playing this high-impact contact sport when they're that young. You can still have football, but, you can start playing when you're 15, 16. I mean, he says the age of consent. He seems to be implying 18. That's a little extreme. There are several, Dr. Robert Cantu, for example, at Boston University, who studied this a lot, intensely, one of the world's most foremost expert on head trauma. He advocates not playing tackle football till 14 years old. Huh. And that's kind of gotten a little bit of traction, and we've seen anecdotal stories around the country of, even in places like Texas, dropping youth football programs. And some stats that have been compiled seems to show that youth football participation is declining. And that doesn't mean that you can't, if you don't play football until high school, you can still be a football player. I think what people are saying is that you shouldn't be banging heads when you're that young, because the science seems to suggest that the more blows to the head that you suffer, the more you are at risk of developing, brain damage. So, it's just a math problem where you kind of cut out the early blows to the head, and hopefully that'll have a more positive result.
In fact, we'll be picking up on some of that with our guests who are listening to our conversation. Sean, I haven't seen the film yet, but I've read a number of reviews about it. How does the NFL come across in the film? And a number of the reviewers said they come across the way the tobacco industry has come across in its denial of the dangers of tobacco.
Yeah, that's fair. I think the NFL will not come out and advertise and say, go see this movie on Christmas Day. They'd rather you stay home. They won't say that publicly, but
stay home and watch football, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. They are the boogeyman in this movie. I think my takeaway from it is it could have been a lot worse for the NFL if the movie had spent more time on the actual victims of CTE, portraying their struggles, because when the movie did portray the struggles of Mike Webster and some other players, those were the most kind of emotionally powerful and terrifying scenes. And so, what in the story of Dr. Malu, it's a dramatic story. However, I, for example, there was a love story involved. I felt like that was kind of like checking a box off, saying, if we're going to make a movie about brain science, we must have a love story to appeal it to the widest possible demographic. It felt kind of forced. So I thought the NFL, in a small way, caught a little bit of a break, because if the movie was about, say, Mike Webster, more about Mike Webster and other victims of CTE, as opposed to almost exclusively about Dr. Malu, it could have been more. It just would have been a more emotionally, kind of riveting movie, and as a viewer, you could have been more, could have been more visceral, scary reaction, and you could say, I'm never watching football again, you know? So, although it's not great for the NFL, I don't think it's going to change the trajectory of the NFL, which we should note, despite all the controversies over head trauma in the last 5, 6, 7 years, the NFL their business has not suffered one bit. Ratings are still strong. Everybody watches the Super Bowl. The league is still a healthy money machine. So, you know, there's all that, you know, despite all the negative headlines,
people are still watching.
Americans are still watching football in record numbers.
Would you say the NFL has in any way changed the way the game is played, made it less of a contact sport?
It's hard to say it's less of a contact sport because you saw this, you know, with the New York Giants Carolina Panthers game last week where Odell Beckham Jr., the star receiver for the Giants, you know, executed a flying headbutt on one of the other players after a play was over. It was a very violent act. And so they've tried to change the rules around the edges where, you know, head-to-head contact is penalized and fined and possible suspensions. There are scientists up in the booth kind of looking to see if there's head contact and taking people out of the game. The concussion protocol, you have to sit out for longer periods of time than in the past and get cleared to return to play. So they've made good faith efforts to manage this. But at the end of the day, you can't avoid head-to-head contact in football, you know, on random plays. You know, it's bound to happen. It's as long as you have tackling in football, there's bound to be head-to-head contact, especially at the line of scrimmage. Every play, the linemen are banging heads. It's lower impact than, say, a wide receiver being smashed in the open field. However, the science is suggesting that the multiple blows to the head that linemen like Mike Webster have suffered, you know, on every play, even if they're lower impact, they add up over time. And so that's not going away under the current rules. So to really it's a balancing act, but to change the only way to kind of reduce, really, really eliminate or as much as you can head injuries is to fundamentally change the way football is played. And people love the way football is played. So there's this kind of catch 22 here that no one's really kind of really addressed.
And Sean, we're almost out of time here. If you love professional football, are you going to hate this movie?
I don't think you should hate the movie. I think it's enlightening. You know, you could come away thinking what you want. I think people will see this movie and say, oh, man, that was terrible. The NFL really should not have gone after Dr. Malu. Oh, man. Oh, let's go watch the Giants and the Eagles. You know, like, I don't think you'll, if you love the game, you might not think it's totally fair to cast the NFL as the, you know, boogeyman. But I don't think, you know, you shouldn't say that it was a total hatchet job.
Sean,
you
we got
away with it, knowing the risks, and, you know, you make up your
we
mind.
We got to go. Sean Gregory, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio
no
Times. Thanks
it.
So much. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The new movie Concussion, starring Will Smith, opens on Christmas Day, and it documents the findings of a forensic neuropathologist, Dr. Bennett Omalu, who identified a brain disease affecting ex-NFL players. Joining us now are Ryan Tierney. He's director of Temple University's Sports Concussion Laboratory, also an associate professor of kinesiology at Temple University, where he and his colleagues focus their research on concussive and subconcussive head impacts. Ryan Tierney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Also with us is Christy Arbogast. She's co-scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's also a research associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. And Christy Arbogast, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, we're interested in, would you let your children play contact sports? Let's just put it out there. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Christy, let me begin with you. And Ryan, I want to get you in on the conversation as well. What is CTE?
CTE is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a neurodegenerative disease of the brain that has been identified in a variety of different populations. The focus of our discussion is it being identified in football players, but it's also been identified in boxers, military, and other populations. And CTE tends to be associated with manifestation during life of depression, anxiety, violent behavior, a whole host of behaviors that are undesirable. The important thing, though, is CTE can only be diagnosed in the dead. It is a pathology condition. And so that's where I think some of the uncertainty is developing around this topic.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me turn to you, Ryan. So what does a brain look like that has CTE? When you look at it, what do you see?
Well, I'm not a neuropathologist by any means, but having seen some images, essentially the brain's response to repetitive stress, it's an organ that isn't supposed to be receiving these repetitive stresses, right? Not a muscle or a tendon or a ligament. So part of the response of the brain is laying down of these proteins, tau proteins, and they can ultimately cause dysfunction in neurons that ultimately help us, do our activities of daily living.
So I mean, a brain looks different. I'm being really concrete here. So it looks very different because of the sort of repetitive stresses to the brain.
Sure. Somebody with CTE would have probably atrophy. So the brain will look smaller in certain areas and in certain staining of the brain in postmortem specimens. There'll be this protein that is very evident where in a quote-unquote normal brain, you wouldn't see it.
And as you said, unlike tendons or bones, it doesn't heal. I mean, this is a permanent damage to the brain. I realize we're talking about people who are dead, but nonetheless.
Right now, I don't know of any treatment or therapy that would reduce it. Right. Once the process kind of starts,
And how about for children? I mean, I think that in many ways, from my own perspective, Christy, is adults can make their own decisions about what they want to do with their lives within certain parameters, of course. But with children, I think it raises questions about their brain development, the kind of impact that a young brain can sustain. What do we know about that?
So I think as parents, we're always managing risk for our children. Whether that's, riding their bike across the neighborhood to go visit their buddy or participating in contact sports. And so when we think of a child and a family making that decision, there's a risk side of the equation and a reward side of the equation. It's been well documented the many positive attributes that come from playing sports. Reduction in obesity, reduction in chronic disease, teamwork, leadership, resilience. All of those things are on the reward side of the equation. And so we need to think about the risk side of the equation and balance those. And there's a variety of strategies I think we can do to make that balance a little more even.
Well, and it's interesting because I'll go back to you, Ryan. We're talking about, concussion, but also subconcussive head impacts. I think it's important to know the distinction or the difference between the two. I'm assuming concussion, you essentially get what, knocked out?
Nope. No, you
don't. Okay.
No.
Well, fair enough. That's why you're here. No,
well, that's
ahead.
Funny. But back in the day, loss of consciousness was one sign that people would use to say, yes, all right, that's a concussion.
Right.
Whereas today, that's altogether different. I certainly don't need to have loss of consciousness to be diagnosed with a concussion. A concussion would be something where you have this head acceleration event. So whether it's a direct blow to the head or it can be to the body where the head is shaken somewhat violently.
Right.
And then from that head acceleration event, there are clinical signs and symptoms that could manifest. And those signs and symptoms can be transient, kind of come and go, and some can last for a certain period of time. A subconcussion would be something where, you can take a hit to the head or get your head shaken, but there's no manifestation of clinical signs and symptoms. Different ways to assess it, kinematically, or kind of describing and measuring head motion. People have tried to identify a kinematic threshold. So, depending on the level of the impact, the amount of head acceleration that's experienced, you know, then we'll see a concussion. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, it's not that easy. There'll be some studies that say you have a 25% risk of sustaining a concussion if you have a 60 G, to unit of acceleration, mm-hmm. a 60 G hit. So anything below that would therefore be, let's say, a subconcussive blow. Your 20 to 30 G hit, that might be experience of the offensive lineman that we talked about earlier.
Right.
That would be subconcussive.
And do we know, Chrissy, whether if we're talking about CTE, the kind of injury that seems to come from these contact sports, is it the one sort of big blow to the head, or is it are people at risk when a series of subconcussive blows over a longer period of time, or do we know?
We don't. I think that is a key unanswered question. I don't think there has been well-documented evidence that playing collision and contact sports as a youth leads to the development of CTE much later in life. To do that requires an extensive longitudinal study. I think that study should be done.
Yes.
And I think we need funding and resources to be able to do that as a scientific community. But that question has not been answered with the current data we have now.
But with all that we do not know, and I'm sure parents listening to this want to know, okay, you know, my son or my daughter is playing a contact sport. I'm back to you, Chrissy. Let's say there's a hit of some sort. What's the protocol? What's the approach today?
Well, I think what parents can do in this current period where we don't have all the scientific answers is be an advocate for their child. Make sure they are participating in a league with a coach that's trained to recognize the symptoms of concussion, that they have a stated concussion protocol. I think at the youth level, if there is any concern, we remove them from play. When in doubt, sit them out is the catchphrase that's promoted by the CDC. And I think for youth, that should be undeniable. And then you want a coach that respects the return to play process and recognizes that that's individual. One athlete may recover much quicker than another athlete. We don't know why yet, but we know that that happens. And so having that coach respect that even if that big championship game is next week, if Johnny is still demonstrating symptoms, he shouldn't be back on the field. And so parents just need to be engaged in the league and coaches that their children are participating with.
And what are the symptoms people should look for? And can you address that, Ryan?
Sure. Actually, I'm holding in my hands here something people can actually look up. It's the SCAT-3. It's a standard concussion assessment tool. If you just Google it, you can find it. But common signs and symptoms of concussion would be something like headache, pressure in the head, neck pain, dizziness, blurred vision, balance problems, sensitivity to light or noise, confusion. But ultimately, you know, mom and dad kind of know when Johnny's
sure.
not acting right. And even if, you know, one thing that's sometimes difficult about concussion is the symptoms may manifest, maybe not that day, you know, during the big game, they take a hit to the head, they seem fine. But 24, 48 hours later, they're complaining of a headache. And I'll think back, you know, hey, was there a hit during the game?
Right.
And then, you know, just in beginning a management protocol.
And rest until the symptoms go away, Chrissy?
Yes. The current treatment for concussion is both cognitive and physical rest, on a timeline, again, that's individual. There is no, you must rest for X number of days. It's until those symptoms begin to subside, and then you kind of test it. Maybe I'll do a little bit of homework and see if those symptoms manifest themselves. Maybe I'll go out for a walk and see if those symptoms manifest themselves. So there's this kind of staged return to play and return to learn, because
right.
we're talking about kids whose job is to go to school, to keep progressing along these stages until they are symptom-free.
And does a young brain, a growing, evolving brain, does it heal itself?
I think that 80% of concussions tend to resolve on their own. If you let them kind of move through this grade 8 graduated return to play and return to learn protocol, I think the challenge we have is in youth, cognitively, we're asking these kids to do a lot. They are in school learning new material every day. And so their brain is constantly being stressed in what we're asking them to do normally. And so if they have some brain injury and we're asking them to keep pushing that, I think that's where those symptoms manifest themselves. It's why sometimes youth take longer to recover than adults.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me quickly reintroduce you. I'm not surprised. Lots of people that want to join the conversation. We're talking about what we know and perhaps what we don't know about concussion, CTE. The new movie Concussion opens on Christmas Day. Chrissy Arbogast is co-scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's also a research associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Ryan Tierney, and he's director of Temple University's Sports Concussion Laboratory and associate professor of kinesiology at Temple University. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Let me get Mark from Newtown to join us. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. My question has to do with the implications of the documentary Frontline on this concussion issue in the NFL and soccer players. And it's based on, during that Frontline documentary, they featured the tragic story of a high school boy who played football. And if my memory's right, he had never suffered a serious head injury, yet he committed suicide. And the scientist doctor who examined his brain found that he had the same pathology as the NFL players who had these symptoms. And so the argument was that the sub-concussion blows to the head over time have a very detrimental impact. And so my question is, soccer players from a very early age go through all of these training regimens where they're constantly heading the ball, sometimes in game situations where it's at rocket speed, and they're heading the ball. And I wonder, is anybody studying that? And do we know anything about the danger
sure.
of that and its impact on children's health?
Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Can I toss it back to you, Ryan?
Yeah, sure. I could say there was a study done by a Michael Lipton where he asked soccer players about the number of head impacts they had in the previous season. And then he also studied cognitive ability, maybe did some imaging. In the previous season, this was kind of striking. The number of head impacts reported were up in the thousands. But when they divided people by greater or less than 1,800 impacts, the groups were a little bit different. Now, that was different in terms of cognitive ability and some imaging changes as well. So, again, level of impact, number of impacts,
right.
It may certainly be playing a role.
But what I also hear you saying, Christy, and both of you, is you can't necessarily do the cause and effect. I mean, that every brain is different.
It is. And, I think the young man that the caller is referring to is a University of Pennsylvania football player. And it's important to recognize that one of the great advances in this field is I think we've become more aware of the symptoms of concussion. So I would like to think that with the advent of athletic trainers and coaches training, these are key aspects to identifying these injuries. So there may be individuals that may not have had a diagnosed concussion, but maybe it was missed. There's data to suggest that about 50% of concussions go unreported. So we need to get smarter as a community, a sports community, in making sure we find the ones that exist and get them into the treatment plan. I think with regard to soccer, there have been some advances in raising the age at which heading is taught and included in the game. And I think that goes to managing the risk. Do we know that there's some magic age? No. But perhaps 5-year-olds shouldn't be heading, but maybe 15-year-olds can.
Let me quote something that was in the New York Times. The American Journal of Sports Medicine determined that among college athletes, concussions were most likely in wrestling, followed by men's hockey, and then women's hockey and women's soccer and women's basketball in that order were right behind football in terms of danger of concussion. And so much of the focus, Ryan and Christy, are on football. And certainly this new movie is all about the NFL and concussion and obviously football. But that's an interesting list of other sports as well, including wrestling.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, it's a contact sport, and even non-contact sports. There is that risk. I've been on the sidelines and in the dugouts of softball games where people have just collided because of improper placement, or the ball goes here or there. Sometimes you won't be able to prevent all the impacts, even in the non-contact sports. So the risk is there when playing those physical activities.
We're almost coming to break here, but is there a danger of sort of overreacting to all of this, Christy?
Of course. we know that sports are positive for children. And so if that overreaction results in people removing their children from sports, I don't think we've done a good service to that child. Sports provides a great environment, teaches them teamwork. I think what we have to focus on is making sports safer. And there are strategies that we can do, even now when we don't have all the scientific answers, to make that activity safer and allow them to still gain the benefits.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We got a lot of people that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A tweet from Janet: no football for my kids. My son is 3 months old. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wing. We're talking about contact sports, the brain CTE, which stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, identified as a brain injury and, of course, a controversy within the NFL. And it does raise a whole host of questions about children playing sports and what they need to know. And again, our guests are Christy Arbogast, co-scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Ryan Tierney, director of Temple University's Sports Concussion Laboratory. 1-888-477-9499. Christy, you said an interesting thing during the break, which is half of concussions that you see, what, at Penn?
At CHOP.
At
yes.
CHOP, yep. Are not sports related.
No, if you look at our data across the whole age range, from like 0 to 17 years of age, about 50% of concussions occur outside the athletic field. Motor vehicle crashes, falls, just kids playing. I mean, we aren't going to ban those things.
Right.
There are strategies we've done to make them safer. If you think of motor vehicle crashes, we have restraints. We have laws and rules. We need to do the same for sports.
Well, and we had that tweet from a mother or father of a three-month-old. But, Ryan, I mean, any child that learns to walk is going to whack their head every now and then, yeah?
Yes, that is true. I have five of them, so I know.
Yeah, but, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I mean, how resilient, I guess, is the brain? And if we're talking about children's brain, how resilient is it? I mean, obviously, certain things are going to cause serious injury, but the sort of wear and tear that we're talking about in some instances, does it recover from that?
That's actually a great point. Even with the playing of sports, people have been playing sports for decades, soccer, football, et cetera, and the large majority are successful adults. The studies that come out can be very scary. Typically, though, they're talking about retired NFL players who went through a time and period where management may not have been as good as it is now. And certainly strategies that Christy was mentioning may not have been in place, but they are now. So we kind of think we're doing a better job. You know what? I mean, the head impacts and accelerations that kids take on a daily basis, mm-hmm. we really don't know too much about them.
Well, I mean, and just to put it in context, Christy, which is we're talking about the NFL. These are people who probably played football their whole lives, obviously played professionally as adults, playing a game, you know, played by really strong big men pushing each other around a football field.
Exactly. And I think what is coming out in the literature is that there are things you can do at the youth level, changing the rules, changing the ways the coaches are certified. There's been studies in youth hockey. They changed the age at which you can begin to do body checking and have shown that that has been a positive thing for injury. The USA football has a heads-up coaches certification program. And there was a really important study released this year that showed that teams that followed that program had a 30% reduction in concussion.
Wow.
So there are things we can do. We need to make sure those things are universally applied to make those activities safer.
And what about helmets and all of that? How critical is that?
Helmets were initially designed to prevent skull fractures and more serious brain injuries, and they do that. So keep helmets on.
Yes.
What we don't know is whether helmets prevent concussion. Just the way concussion happens, the helmets as currently designed don't necessarily mitigate that risk. But I think having a properly fitted helmet helps reduce overall head injuries and should still be advocated. There's some exciting research going on about how can we improve helmets to prevent concussion, but we aren't quite there yet.
You want to add anything to that, Ryan? Then we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's a physics problem. So you know, the amount of force applied is going to accelerate your head of a certain mass. So if you can reduce the force by maybe having it absorbed in some way by the helmet, there you're ultimately going to reduce the acceleration. Mm. If you can strengthen the head and neck, that
helps too.
In theory, yes, it should. To help with that physics problem there. There are technologies that are trying to improve upon in terms of helmet technology, but probably not preventing concussion though.
Let me see what Mia from looks like Wincoat has to say. Mia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am calling to tell you about my son, who is now 8, but last year he was 7. He fell in gym playing Daga, which doesn't seem to be a high head injury sport typically, but he suffered a concussion. And the effects were not immediate, but about an hour later, he started losing speech and he couldn't walk. And The school was very concerned and called me right away. We took him to the emergency room and they diagnosed him with a concussion and said his speech would return, which thank goodness it did later on that afternoon. We gave him darkness and, you know, no reading. He was stuck with Play-Doh in the corner. But a few weeks later, after he had returned to school, he began to experience some really severe anxiety, which we went to the doctor about. We got an EEG for him, saw a neurologist, but we believe it was triggered by the concussion. And we treated him with therapy and time, and after a few months, he was back to himself. And he's playing sports again, although it was sort of a week-by-week basis. We let him play basketball for practice, but we wouldn't let him play in the games.
Uh-huh.
And I think, like, there's just so much we don't know about our children's brains that I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all.
Well, and Mia,
how we handle concussions.
No, I appreciate the call, and I'm glad that your son is doing better. And that's one of the takeaways that I'm getting from our conversation, which is that there is no one size fits all. Let me put to you, Christy. Mia says a darkness that she sort of kept, I guess, the sunlight out of the poor kid in the corner playing with Play-Doh. But is that a way to treat concussion?
Well,
I'm not
a clinician, but my clinical colleagues at CHOP, Dr. Tina Master and Matt Grady, have taught me a lot. And I think the key is to put them in an environment, both with regard to physical activity and cognitive activity, that doesn't elicit symptoms. So what that means for one child may be different than the other. You know, we talk about, well, they shouldn't text, they should limit their screen time. But maybe for one child, watching mindless TV is not eliciting those symptoms, and that may be fine. For another kid, watching TV might send that headache you know, off the edge. So it's totally individual, as Mia mentioned. One size fits all doesn't work, and you need to make sure that, particularly when we're dealing with kids, that you have a pediatrician's perspective. 5-year-old is different from an 8-year-old, is different from a 15-year-old. And we need to incorporate that into these treatment plans.
And Ryan, what I also hear both of you saying is it's, in many ways, it's about symptoms. I mean, watching that the symptoms will tell you something about what's happening to the brain.
Sure. So the manifestation of symptoms after an event is an important indicator of an injury. And then also, making sure the clinician, as a parent, I kind of have an educated eye, but making sure the clinician is doing a comprehensive assessment, which includes not just simply saying, talking about signs and symptoms, but doing a cognitive, neurocognitive test. One that comes to mind is IMPACT test, a computer test.
Is it a test you do on the computer?
Yes.
To sort of see how things are going
processing,
upstairs?
Sure. And then, but also looking at balance. And also looking at the eyes. A lot of the research now is coming out over the past few years, looking at vestibular and ocular motor signs and symptoms. So, you know, people may be suffering, kids, adults, whoever, may be suffering because longer than needed because something's been missed, let's say with ocular motor or eye tracking. And that's something that, you know, could be rehabbed and might be back sooner than later.
Let me see what Lou from thanks for calling me. We've got Lou now from Lower Merion joining us in Radio Times. Hi, Lou. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. This discussion is fascinating and one I'm very interested in. I'm a parent of 3 children, ranging in age from 12 to 6. They all play sports of one kind or another, ice hockey, baseball, gymnastics. But I'm also a former football player. I played from 3rd grade all the way through college. Played offensive line, center, the same position as Mike Webster, so, you know, was very familiar with those impacts. And I never had a concussion, at least not one that was diagnosed, but it's something that I sort of wonder about for myself. But for my kids, you know, I got a lot out of playing football, the camaraderie, the teamwork. It provided opportunities for education that I might not have had if I hadn't played. So there's a lot of value in it. And my middle son is in 5th grade now, and 7th grade in our area is the first time there's really organized football, and he's sort of interested. So it's a discussion my wife and I have, and what will we do, you know, if he still is interested in a couple of years. And I guess hearing the conversation today is helpful. I agree there's a lot more awareness now than there was, you know, 30 years ago when I was a youth playing sports, about how to prevent, how to detect, how to treat concussions. So I think that, you know, that makes the decision different, because you have that awareness, and you have hopefully the well-trained coaches and trainers who can spot things and make sure that things don't become worse than they could.
Well, you know, Lou, I don't think you're the only parent. In fact, I know you're not the only parent out there that wants to do the right thing and wants to make the right decision. And obviously something you have to decide, you and your wife have to decide for yourself. But Christy, I'd be curious what you say in response. We were talking about this off the air because it's such an important question.
It is. And, you know, I think that some of the advocacy that's out there now to ban sports is not the right answer. I think the concept of having more flag football leagues, that is not a bad idea. I think teaching our kids the other skills that are part of these sports, speed, agility, fitness, that is very important during these developmental stages of as a kid goes through middle school and enters high school. So I think we do need to look to either the governing bodies of these sports or the local leagues and push them a little bit to give other options that minimize the exposure. Maybe we've seen of minimizing contact practices, but maybe flag football up to a certain age is a good idea. We don't know what that magic age is, but, you know, perhaps tackling at 5 is not the best idea.
Also, I would think just interviewing the coach, I mean, finding out what their credentials are, what their philosophy is. I mean, that, that also seems, Ryan, would be helpful for parents.
Sure. Yeah, a coach who's maybe teaching proper technique or improper technique would be something that is important to identify. And, you know, I'm not going to put my son or daughter out there if I see something that doesn't make sense and they're not willing to change. So.
Let me see what Dan from Center Valley, Pennsylvania has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a PIAA official, football official.
Oh,
and,
excellent.
I'm very happy to hear that, that you're having this discussion. And I was going to comment that in terms of how we are instructed with concussions, we are told to treat them like any other injury. If we see a player who is injured, we are instructed to, you know, stop the game at the next stoppage of play and instruct the team that they need to, you know, remove the player. We are told that we are not medical professionals. We are not supposed to tell medical personnel or trainers that this player has a concussion. We are merely supposed to stop the game and tell the team you need to take this, you know, number 21 out for at least one play.
Right.
It is totally the responsibility of the medical professionals and training staff of each team to determine if that child returns to the game.
And Dan, I mean, I think that's, I'm really glad you called. I know Christy sort of put two thumbs up when you called in, Dan. Sounds like you want to respond.
Yeah, I think the officials play a critical role here. This is all about having extra sets of eyes, and the officials are the ones with the closest view of what's going on. I read a statistics this week that said 25% of concussions occur during illegal or aggressive plays. So that would say, let's enforce the rules we already have, and the people that hold that key are the officials. So, Dan, thanks for bringing up this issue. You guys really play a critical role in help minimizing the risk.
You want to add to that, Ryan?
Yeah, and I think and I know, especially at youth sports, many of the coaches are volunteers, and you know now they're being asked to assess these medical or injuries. And but I think you know, if you're going to be a volunteer, then you know, gaining some knowledge in areas such as you know, basic first aid and injury is important.
About a minute before I have to end the conversation, I'm thinking about Dan's call, which if a player gets injured with a broken leg. That's pretty obvious. I mean, how obvious is it if a player, Chrissy, might have a concussion?
Well, I think I echo Ryan's comments that there are some really well-done coaching certification programs and coaching training programs. The one I can think of is the Centers for Disease Control has their Heads Up program for coaches. It's an online training program of how to recognize these symptoms because they aren't as obvious as a broken leg, but really steps through the coaches, what should you be looking for. I've also heard of leagues identifying one of the parents as another eye, that their job, and maybe it rotates game to game, to be looking for these things as well. So there are some tools out there that can get people more knowledgeable about the topic.
We have to end our conversation on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Such an important topic. Christy Arbogast, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Co-scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's also research associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. Ryan Tierney, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of Temple University Sports Concussion Laboratory, also associate professor of kinesiology at Temple University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on satellite radio, sign up for our newsletter. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.